We are.
Yes.
All right, Perek Chaf. Perek Chaf. We are. We spent a great deal of time looking at the story, the background story of the Pilegesh and the Levi and the events that took place in the city of Givah. And we are ready to look at Perek Chaf, which is the story of the response, the war, the civil war. As I mentioned before, there are several civil wars recorded in Sefer Shoftim. We looked at the smaller versions. We've seen the smaller civil wars already. We saw by civil war by Gidon when he went to war against Pnuel and Sukkot, and Yiftach against Bnei Ephraim, which is a much which is a larger scale war. This one is going to top the scale even of Yiftach. So let's go back to the beginning of the parak. We're going to, just to sort of put us back into the mindset, opening psukim of this parak we have read, but I want to reread them and read. My goal today is to go through the parak, at least as much of it as we can, and then we'll have next week to discuss a little bit. Class, let's go.
Right.
Parak Chaf. Vayetzu kol bnei Yisrael vatikahel ha'ida ke'ish echad lemidan v'ad be'sheva. Everybody with me? Parak Chaf. No, I'm just making sure everybody's on the right page. All of Israel gathered, ke'ish echad, in unity, unity of purpose, unity of focus. Limidan v'ad Be'er Sheva. Famous expression, Dan to Be'er Sheva. Dan in the north, of course, referring to Be'er Sheva in the south. V'eretz ha-gilad, east, El Hashem ha-mitzpah, gathered together in Mitzpah. Mitzpah is probably a hilltop overlooking Givav Binyamin. And Mitzpeh, there are a few places in Tanakh that are referred to as Mitzpeh. In modern Israel, a lot of cities are named Mitzpeh because they're built at the top of hills. Mm-hmm. There was a period of time when actually it was by policy they used to build yeshuvim, kibbutzim yeshuvim, on the top of hills for security purposes, but they were all called Mitzpeh. Mitzpeh this, Mitzpeh that. So that essentially is what the word mitzpeh means. What just happened? Oh, I see. Okay. Vayityatzvu pinot kol ha'am, kol shiftei Yisrael, bikahal am ha'elokim. All of the people gathered from the corners of the people, everybody, one big gathering of the nation of God, 400,000 elef ish ragli, 400,000 Israelites with drawn swords. Purpose clear. Pasuk Yemo. Vayishmu b'nei Binyamin ki alu b'nei Yisrael mitzpah. B'nei Binyamin heard. Right, it's not hard to hear that 400,000 soldiers have gathered on the hilltop opposite you. You don't need a satellite to figure that out. Vayamru b'nei Yisrael dabru echani eta ra'a zot b'Yisrael ra'a zot. Okay, so now they start to investigate. After they've come, they've got their swords, 400,000 soldiers responding to the package that they got in the mail. Now they are ready for war. Let's hear the facts. What's the expression? Ready, fire, aim?
Ready, fire, aim.
I think makes more sense in this case. Vayan ha'ish ha'levi. Ish ha'isha ha'nirtzacha. Now suddenly this Levi's wife was murdered. And he's ha'giv'ata ashele binyamin bati ani ufilakshi lalun. He tells the story. I came to Giv'av Binyamin together with my pilagesh. We needed a place to live, to sleep overnight. Vayakumu alai balea giv'ah.
the people of the Giva surrounded my the house at night. Oti dimu laharog et pilagshi inu vatamot. Me they threatened to kill, and my pilagish they violated and oppressed, and she died. I think we spoke about this once before, the ability to pervert a conclusion based on selective facts.
It's called selective memory.
Well, selective memory or selective facts or selective testimony, however you want to describe it. In the end, the picture gets distorted because you leave out a couple of little pieces of salient information.
Was this 400,000 like a common... I mean, or is that extra?
It's the largest gathering of soldiers in Sefer Shoftim, 350 years worth.
Because the population
No, not because the population has grown. Why is it larger than any previous gathering of war?
Because all the tribes are involved.
Because all the tribes are present. Even Devorah could not get all the tribes. Remember the Shirat Devorah? She complained about which tribes came and which tribes didn't.
Yeah.
She tried to get them all to come, and they wouldn't. So 350 years, even Devorah couldn't get all the tribes together. So Kol Ish Yisrael, we're talking about, and we'll see how extensive the unity of this great gathering was, we'll see. But it was really quite unprecedented.
I think it makes a difference in the big picture.
Sure. Va'ochez b'filagshi, so I took my pilagash, va'anatcheha, va'ashacheha b'chol sedei nechalat Yisrael, ki asu zima u'nevala b'Yisrael. I took my pilagash, I sent her via parcel post to all the different tribes of Israel, because this abomination had been done. Again, the relationship between him and his pilagash and the abomination of how he treated her is not part of his testimony. Irrelevant from his perspective, and unfortunately, therefore not part of the equation from their perspective. Hine kolchem bnei Yisrael havu lachem davar ve'etza halom. Give counsel, speak, respond, act. Vayakum kol ha'am ki ish echad lemor. For the second time, ki ish echad, all of Israel responded as one. No man may go back to his tent. Nobody may go home to his house. Nobody may leave until we right this wrong. Charge to Giv'ah Binyamin. The word is charge. Alea Bagoral. Goral means a lottery, but it was an expression of how to go to war. Because you went to war, usually by Goral. You went to the Umvatum, and the Umvatum told you which Shevet would lead. Oh. That was called a Goral. So Allah by Goral essentially is another way of saying, draw the swords and start to charge down the mountain to a war.
Are the proportions troubled by this, by the fact that you get 400,000 soldiers to go to right an individual wrong? There's got to be more going on.
The Mufashim got a town on this. We'll see. This is really horrific.
ולקחנו עשרה אנשים למאה לכל שבטי ישראל ומאה לאלף ואלף לרבבה לקחת צדה לעם לעשות לבועם לגבע בנימין ככל נבלה אשר עשה בישראל.
Certain portion, 10% of the people set aside for carrying provisions and the war takes, army moves on its stomach. Need to organize ourselves, 400,000 men, we're going to war. Against Geva of Binyamin. Now, bear in mind that at this point in time, the focus is on vengeance against the city of Geva. The city of Geva. What will end up happening is much more extensive. But for now, their focus and their anger is specifically against the people of Giv'ah.
Vayasef kol ish Yisrael el ha'ir.
They gathered against the city. Ke'ish echad chaverim. One big happy family. like friends.
You never think of that when you sing
Barney style, right? Barney style. I love you, you love me.
We're a happy family.
We're a happy family. Ki isha chaverim. Kiddush HaChodesh. Ko Yisrael. Ko Yisrael. Chaverim ko Yisrael. Kiddush HaChodesh. Right? We talked about this phrase.
It's hard to believe it comes from this.
This is where it comes from. It's the only place it appears.
Wow.
Now I'll go one step further. Do we have a Cincino parish in translation here? Is there a Cincino? Do you know if there's a Cincino on the shelf?
No.
I'll go one step further. I found in the Cincino commentary a statement that I think was really astounding. And I had to read it twice before I realized what it was saying. So I copied it into my notes. Cincino quotes the following, makes the following comment in his translation, in the commentary on this verse. The unanimity of Israel speaks highly of the national character at this time.
Oh, that's loaded, isn't it?
Say it again.
The unanimity of Israel speaks highly of the national character at this time. All united, one big happy family.
Except for one.
The irony of it is astounding. Think about it for a moment. Think about all we have learned in Sefer Shoftim. If you take the pattern that we have identified from the very beginning of our study of Sefer Shoftim till now, one pattern is two major themes, but one of the two major themes that has emerged time after time, story after story, was the breakdown of the sense of national identity or national character in favor of tribal affiliation. We saw it the very, very beginning. We saw it by Devorah and Barak, when she calls all the tribes together and she begins in her shira to berate half the tribes for sitting on their sheep instead of coming and fighting the war. We saw it by Gideon, who took his army after he finished with Midian and came back and wiped out the cities of Penuel and Sukkot because they had the chutzpah not to help him in the war. We saw it by Yiftach, because of Bnei Ephraim, a little bit upset that they weren't called to help, they didn't get a chance to claim the glory. Yiftach wipes them out and slaughters 42,000 of them. We have seen a complete breakdown of any sense of the marriage relationship between one tribe and another. We saw both by Yiftach and here.
And Shimshon.
And Shimshon, Bnei Yehuda, giving him over into the hands of the Plishtim. To suggest that this verse speaks highly of the national character, maybe I would give him the benefit of the doubt, but I'm not sure that it would work. But certainly, since he's a collection of commentaries, in this particular case, he quotes a. The Cincino translation commentary is an interesting story because he quotes a lot of Gentile commentaries, a lot of Christian commentaries. This one is he quotes somebody by the name of Lias or Lias, L-I-A-S. I have no idea who that is. But I find from time to time the Cincino commentary footnote really interesting observations. This is one of them. The other one I showed you was backed by Gideon, when there's this verse in Gideon where they talk about Bnei Ephraim in Menashe, in Gilad. They don't know what to do with this verse, and Cincino's comment is something to the effect of modern scholarship has given up hope of trying to understand this verse. And it just, every once in a while, they comes up with interesting observations, and this is one of
Isn't
them.
Isn't Cincino used in a lot of biblical classes?
Cincino wrote a number of different things. It's a publishing company, so they did a translation, a scholarly translation commentary on Tanakh. They did a scholarly translation and critical commentary footnotes on the Talmud, so the Talmud translation. In fact, all the translations that I have in my source pages in English are taken from Cincino because it's the only database I have access to on a CD that has the English translations of the Talmud, Medrash Rabbah, Zohar, and Tanakh. So for me, it was just easier to always take from there, but I'm not particularly... That's why it's a very old English and a very... It's a very hard English. So one of the phrases that I have in here is reproacheth the Lord. Anyway, it's an old English, old commentary.
When was it written?
If I had one here, I would look it up. But it's in the last generation.
50s?
I don't know for sure, but certainly within the...
I got a set in the 60s, so I had to at least that old.
Yeah. But anyway, it was just an observation that I thought was interesting, because I would have gone the other direction.
We're very divided.
I would have gone the direction that there is unity here. There is unity here. It says, Kol Yisrael, it says three times it describes Kol Ish Yisrael, ki ish echad b'lev echad. You want to talk about unity, there is no question that there is unity. But I would not have ascribed to this unity a high national character. I would have ascribed to this unity a very nefarious agenda. The closest analogy, it is a mob. It absolutely is a mob. The closest analogy to this kind of unity for a negative purpose that I think we would find in Tanakh would be the Tower of Babel. Unity of language, unity of purpose, unity of focus. And the story that unfolds is their building of the tower, whatever that tower meant, whatever their significance was, whatever their sin was. Certainly it wasn't presented to us in Tanakh as a positive development. And the result of it in the end, if you remember the conclusion of of Migdal Bavel, not only did is that the notion of language, God comes down to disrupt their unity. Essentially what happens in Migdal Bavel, it's worth taking a quick glance at it. It's in Bereishit Perek Yud Aleph. Beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. Chapter 11.
Page 11.
Yeah, it's page 11 too. Okay.
Page 11,
chapter 11. Isn't that filing for bankruptcy or something?
Chapter 11.
Well, mankind goes bankrupt. Vehi kol aretz safa achat udvarim achadim. Man starts with the story about how mankind is suddenly unified. Single language, single focus, single idea. And they, as it unfolds, they head eastward and they begin to build this tower. God gets very upset with them. And he disrupts their effort. If you look at the end of the story, Pasuk Chet, Vayafetz Hashem Otam Misham Al Pnei Kol Haaretz Vayachdalu Livnot Ha'ir. The end result of God's intervention, he introduces language differentiation between them, which is how the text literally reads, or he disrupted their unity of focus and their idea, whatever this particular interpretation of the story is. But the end result is that Hashem scattered them. Vayafetz Hashem otam misham al pnei kol haaretz. And because they became scattered, they could no longer build their tower. Vayachdalu livnot ha'ir. And that's where it's called Bavel, Shem Balal Hashem Sfat Kol Aretz. But the language is secondary. Notice the conclusion. Balal Hashem Sfat Kol Aretz, Hashem confounded, mixed up their languages. Umisham Hefitzam Hashem Opne Kol Aretz, and thereby scattered them over the earth. In other words, the language was only a symptom, and therefore a ability to use as a mechanism by which to achieve the real goal, which was to scatter them, that they shouldn't be unified in this way. Unity doesn't necessarily always bode well. Sometimes unity for a nefarious purpose can be more dangerous than disunity. If we wanted to go into a philosophical discussion about democracy, in a sense, part of the foundation of democratic theory is that by creating an ability for multiple opinions and multiple points of view to express themselves, you balance everybody out so that you don't end up in a unity of purpose for an evil goal. And that's part of the mindset. I always like to talk about the most unified country in the history of modern civilization was Nazi Germany. It was a unified country in the history of modern civilization. The unity by and of itself doesn't necessarily bode well. It has to be balanced and has to be checked and has to be for a constructive purpose. In our case, they're all gathering together for unity of war, which by and of itself and in a vacuum may sound nice, but when you think about the context, both against Binyamin and against Giv'a, suddenly this unity reminds us too closely of Migdal Bavel. And just to, since we're on the analogy, I'll just show you something interesting. Take a look at the very end of the story. How does the story conclude? After it's all over, the war is over, the battle's over, the scars are over, the rehabilitation of Sheva Binyamin is over. Last verse of the book, the second to last verse.
In
Shoftim,
that?
The very second to last verse of the book, it's the very end of the story. Vayitalchu misham b'nei Yisrael ba'etahi. At that time, b'nei Yisrael. Story's all over. So now they're going home. They left there. Ish l'shifto ulemishpachto vayetzu misham ish l'nachalato. Each one went back to his shevet, to his family, to his nachala. That's it. Unity is gone. And then there's the famous statement about Bayimim Ein Melech B'Yisrael. And ultimately, I think that's the issue. The issue is that there really is no unity. The need for a Malchus is to create a constructive unity to replace the only times that the community is that the people of Israel ever gotten together in this book in a unified fashion, which was to beat the drums of war against Shevet Binyamin. So there needs to be something to replace that drive. And so there is the drive for kingship. But that's the analogy that I think is really remarkable. On the one hand, you have this unity that reminds us of Migdal Bavel, and in the end, the conclusion is the same. Just as God scattered them in the case of Migdal Bavel, they scattered themselves here, because ultimately there really wasn't a unified purpose. All right.
More brave people could guide a bit. How similar is that to Nasev and Ishmael when everybody said that? Is that phrase used there too?
It's there. It says Vayomru kol ha'am yachdav Nasev and Ishmael. Actually, the phrase ki ish echad appears in a number of places in Tanakh. Does it appear in Matan Sinai also? Well, Vayachanusham Neged Ahar is based on a verbal a verb conjugation.
Vayichan Sham. So accepted as her of some the Levachad or something.
Yeah, I know Levachad, but I said, oh, I wonder if it's
there's a phrase Keishachad Balevachad which appears in a number of places. Sometimes good and sometimes bad. Tell you in a moment. Now that's not it. Before Matan Torah, it says Ve'anu kol ha'am yachdav. Ve'anu kol ha'am yachdav. Ve'anu kol ha'shediber Hashem na'asa. So there's a unified response, but that.
Right. It's in the nature of man to come together against the common enemy.
Correct.
Isn't
I think coming together against the common enemy is a good thing, especially in a in a sense of national pride and identity is a good thing, but it can be dangerous,
right.
And it can be dangerous. Depends on what your purpose is.
Maybe it didn't, depending on when this really happened, but a sense of them becoming more unified.
From a literary point of view, the author of Sefer Shoftim, which is in this case Shmuel, uses the story as a background for the need for. The events of this story themselves, the story itself is not what leads to the Malchus. It's the end of Sefer end of the story of Shimshon that ultimately leads to Eli and then to Malchus. The story is here really to tell us as a symptom of why what's needed for our purpose. But in the end of the story here, where they just go back, as I just showed you, Ish l'shivto l'mishpachto v'ish l'nachalato. It's not what's leading to Malchus, no. All right. So let's spend a little bit of what I'd like to do in the remaining time that we have is to go through the rest of the parak, at least from a text point of view, to understand the battle. What took place? There's a lot of understanding in this story that we're going to have to discuss, but I just want to try to understand the text. What actually took place? Vayishlechu shivtei Yisrael, Pasuk Yud Bet. Perek Chaf, Pasuk Yud Bet. Vayishlechu shivtei Yisrael, Anashim b'chol shivtei Binyamin lemor. So now, once they've heard from the Levi, and once they've gathered in Mitzpah, Kol ish Yisrael el ha'ir ki ish echad chaverim, ready to draw their swords, then they send representatives to Shevet Binyamin to hear their side, or at least to accuse them of something. Ma hara'a azot asheni atabachem. What kind of terrible evil thing have you done?
A little prejudgment, huh?
Right. V'ata tenu et ha'anashim b'nei b'li ya'al asher b'giva unimitem univara ra'am Yisrael. B'nei Binyamin, give us these b'nei b'li ya'al, worthless people, evil people of Giv'ah, who perpetrated this crime, we will execute them and remove the evil from Israel. Nevara hara'a b'Yisrael. That's their peace envoy to B'nai Binyamin. B'nai Binyamin's response, V'lo avu B'nai Binyamin lishmo b'kol acheihem B'nai Yisrael. B'nai Binyamin refused to listen to their brethren.
Is there a space in the
there's a ketiv and kri, yeah. There's a okay. Ketiv and kri. Well, in the space in the chumash, no. In the Tanakh, it would be printed just without the word, but there's a ketiv and kri. So the kri, there's an extra word. Vayasu b'nei Binyamin mineharim hagivata. Remember, the war was the anger was against
Giva.
So they turned to the rest of b'nei Binyamin and said,
"Give us the bad guy.
Give us the people of Giva." The response was no, and then B'nai Binyamin come to defend the people of Giv'ah. Vayasfu B'nai Binyamin min ha'arim ha'giv'ata latzet la'milchama im B'nai Yisrael. Now the people of Binyamin said, you're not going to take an entire city of ours and wipe it out. That's not going to happen. We're going to defend our own. So the drums of war are beating louder. Vayitpakdu b'nei Binyamin b'yom ahu meha'arim 26,000 ish sholif charev. From all of the cities of Binyamin surrounding, gathered the soldiers, 26,000 drawn swords.
That's not very much compared.
Not compared to the 400,000.
Yeah,
Levad, in addition to Yoshve ha'giv'ah yitpakdu 700 ish b'chor. Out of the city of Giv'ah itself, another 700. So I have 26,000 plus 700 from the city of Giv'ah. 26,000 from the cities of Binyamin, 700 from Giv'ah. And of this group, 26,700, Mikola Amazeh, 700 ish bachur iter yad yemino, another 700 left-handed people. Why left-handed? What's the advantage of left-handed? We saw this in... Who was left-handed? Who was left-handed? We saw this way back when. I actually showed you this pasuk. What famous shofet was left-handed? About whom it says that he was left-handed. And he happened to have been from Shevet Binyamin. But that's only by accident.
Yeah. In other words, statistically, I don't think Shaver. I once had I once asked, I think, I don't remember if it was a statistician or a doctor, to look up the proportions of left-handed people in society. And I don't think the proportion is significantly higher than any other. But the notion of bringing to the battlefield 700 left-handed people was particularly significant. Why?
In tennis, it's very important.
You don't?
And in baseball.
Yeah,
but right. And in baseball, because most people are right-handed, so a left-handed pitcher has an advantage, correct?
Right.
So why is 700 swordsmen?
Because the way that they approach the sword on the other hand may give them advantage against a right-handed swordsman.
Correct. Who's most famous left-handed? Who used that left-handedness to his advantage?
You're talking about in Tanakh.
And Sefer Shoftim.
Who killed Agag?
Who killed who?
What?
Agag?
I mean, wasn't there like the one that who's oozing stomach?
Correct, 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 correct. Yeah. That's the story.
That's
Eglon Melech Moav. Who killed him? Who used the fact that it was left-handed to hide his sword so that he couldn't be seen pulling it out of his sheath because it wasn't expecting him to pull it out of his right side instead of his left? Who was it? Remember the story. Ehud ben Gera, first shofet we learned after Othniel ben Knas. Ehud ben Gera, iter yad yimino, used it to his advantage. A left-handed swordsman is an advantage because it's harder. No, that's two different issues. We'll get to that different part of the phrase. Not only are they 700 swordsmen, but they're also kol ze kolea be'evin ala se'ara v'lo yechati. Each one of them could hit a stone, could a hair. Hit a hair with a stone and not miss.
But then it had nothing to do with the left hand.
They're two different issues. In other words, we would call them
marksmen.
Yeah. 700 marksmen. So you've got 26,000 soldiers plus 700 from Giv'ah plus 700 specialists, special unit forces.
And then, forces.
Special forces. Total fighting force of 27,400. Or let's say 26,700, of which those 700 include special forces, against a mob of 400,000.
But the fourth.
Not good.
15 to 1.
But the 400,000.
Now, look at the paragraph break. The paragraph break is very. This is one story. Why is there a paragraph break here?
I thought you said the 400,000 with everybody.
400,000, everybody milvad b'nei Binyamin. Everybody on the Israel side. There's Ish Yisrael against Ish Binyamin. This war is between
soldiers of Israel and
Binyamin. Let's call it the allied forces of the Shvatim against
Binyamin.
And
the people
from Giv'ah. Giv'ah is part of Binyamin. V'Ish Yisrael hitpakdu levad mi-Binyamin 400,000 ish, sholef charev. Israel's forces, 400,000 besides Binyamin, outside of Binyamin. So here's, they're sitting in Mitzpeh, they're sitting in Binyamin. There's a standoff. Now in the meantime, in this standoff, what happens? Vayakumu, notice this paragraph break. Paragraph breaks usually mean either a break in the story or a pause. Or change the subject. And to go from B'nai Binyamin to B'nai Yisrael and to the next part of the story. Think about it. Notice the paragraph break. About 3 weeks after we get back from our break, we'll come back to this paragraph. V'ish Yisrael hitpakdu levad mi-Binyamin 400,000 ish shalev charef kol ze ish mechama. V'yakumu v'alu Beit El. They turn around. They go up to Beit El. Vayish'alu be'elokim. And there they sought God's counsel. How do you seek God's counsel?
Pray.
Sacrifices.
Pray, sacrifices, all very nice. But when you're going to war, that's not what it means. When you're going to war, what does it mean? You seek the instruction from God as to how to conduct the battle, which means you go to the Kohen Gadol, who wears the breastplate and the Choshen Mishpat. And you ask God, and God gives you an answer as to how, through the Kohen Gadol's
intercession as to how to conduct this war. Not an uncommon phenomenon. Vayomru b'nei Yisrael, they asked God, Mi ya'ale lanu batchila lamilchama b'nei Binyamin? Who, which of this 400,000 soldiers? 400,000 soldiers can't go to war at one time. So somebody has to lead this battle, correct? Mm-hmm. So who leads them into battle? They ask God, who should go first? Vayomer Hashem, Yehuda batchila. Hashem answered them. And he said,
that God is agreeing that they should go to war.
Correct. Right. The theological challenge in this story is this piece. That's the big issue that we're going to have to address. We're going to spend a lot of time on that issue. So that's really the core of the question.
So every time the nation asks God for answers like this in all of these wars, do you always get an answer?
Usually. There isn't... Well, when the Urim V'Tumim refuses to answer, right, it's exceptional. And there are actually examples in Tanakh, stories from which they sought counsel of the Urim V'Tumim and the Urim V'Tumim refused to answer. Right. But usually for... it's usually for some reason, like Shaul HaMelech's famous case where he sought counsel of the Urim V'Tumim and then the war was starting, so he didn't have time to wait for the answer, so he told the Kohen Gadol, okay, forget it, I don't have time for this, and he ran off to war. And then the next time he asked the Urim V'Tumim for counsel, the Urim V'Tumim stayed silent. It's no surprise, right? So there are stories like that in Tanakh, but usually there's a response. In fact, we saw it back in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim.
God did not answer?
No, God did answer. Take a look at the very opening pasuk of Sefer Shoftim. Very opening pasuk, when they're just beginning to conquer the land of Israel, each tribe to its own territory. Vayi achrei mot Yeshua, vayi shalu bnei Yisrael b'Hashem lemor, mi yale lanu al haknani batchila lilachim bo. They sought counsel of God, saying, who should go first to wage war against Kanani? Vayomer Hashem, Yehuda yale. And God answered, Yehuda goes first. Ninatati et ha'aretz b'yado. It's not uncommon for Yehuda to go first. Yehuda always goes first. Right? That was part of the role of Yehuda. So here too, Yehuda goes first. It's very appropriate.
Is there ever a section like how the Urim V'Tumim work? Like, is it each stone was for one of the tribes?
Yeah, there's a whole discussion in the Gemara as to how the Urim V'Tumim work.
Because otherwise, it's basically one word.
Right. So there's one word, but there's also there's all kinds of theories. We don't know for sure, but there's all kinds of theories that there were, the names of each shevet are written on each stone. So there's theories that the letters would light up in certain ways. There's the famous Medrash about Eli, that when he sees, the Gra says this, that when he sees Chanaf praying, and he accuses her of being a shikora. Mm-hmm. So the Gra says, famous words of the Holy God. That the Urim V'Tumim didn't specifically give you words, the Urim V'Tumim gave you letters. Mm. And you had to read... order the letters in the proper sequence. So the Gra says that the letters popped up, but the letters popped up in this fashion. And what Eli didn't realize is that you have to rearrange them to Shera. Right, that's a famous word of the Vilna Gaon. I'm sure you learned it when you did Shmo. So that, as an example, there is a theory to how the Urim V'Tumim work, but it's somewhat conjecture because we don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. We don't have a specific manual as to how the Urim V'Tumim function. It could possibly have worked through Nevuah, where the Kohen Gadol had some kind of Nevuah and he spoke to God and God answered him. But in the time of Tanakh, Nevuah existed, you could do that. Post the world of Tanakh, when Nevuah doesn't exist anymore, that mechanism is lost, so we don't know. Be that as it may, in our case, God says to Ish Yisrael, Yehuda Yale, verbatim, the same question that we saw in the beginning of Sefer Shoftim and almost the same answer. So they start the war. Pasuk Yutet. Vayakumu b'nei Yisrael baboker v'yachanu al agiva. Comes the morning, charge, Yehuda leads the charge.
Vayetze Ish Yisrael Milchama in Binyamin. There's a war. Pasuk Chaf. Vayarchu Vayetze Ish Yisrael Milchama in Binyamin. Vayarchu Itam Ish Yisrael Milchama El Hagiva. The war has now started. They're engaged directly in the battle, Ish Yisrael and Binyamin. Vayetzu b'nei Binyamin min ha-giva. B'nei Binyamin came out of the giva, 26,700 of them, against the combined forces of Yehuda and those behind him. Vayashchitu b'Yisrael b'yom ahu shnayim v'eslim elef ish arza. And they slaughtered 22,000 Israelites. The use of the term vayashchitu is very powerful. It's very powerful. We had it once before. When did we have it?
They were laid low. Laid low doesn't sound
out. No, vayashchitu is much more...
it's like a shchita, it's slaughter.
Well, shchita, shchita, as in slaughter of an animal, is with a tet.
Oh, okay.
Shchita with a taf is l'shachet. L'shachet kol basar, to wipe out.
It's destroy.
Destroy. To destroy 22,000 Israelites. So who won this campaign?
Binyamin so far.
Binyamin in a big way. So here's your odds. 22,700 Binyamin against 400,000 is of the mob. And first campaign they go into with God's instruction, Yehuda goes first. And the result is 22,000 are killed. That's the question in this story that we're going to spend a lot of time trying to figure out. That's the question. That's the question that Ruthie asked before. How could the big theological question of the story is, you know, if they went to war on their own and they lost, it's one thing. But they seek counsel from the Urim V'Tumim. They go to Beit El, and the Mefarshim almost unanimously agree that Beit El here is Shiloh. Radak is a theory that maybe that means that they took the Aron out of Shiloh, brought it to Beit El, which is closer to the battlefield. But most Mefarshim agree that Radak and the Metzudot and others that this is Shiloh. They go to the Mishkan. They ask the Kohen Gadol. We'll see who the Kohen Gadol is in a moment. This is really a process. So the question becomes ultimately, why did the Urim V'Tumim fail them, or why did God trip them? Maybe either
right,
one.
Right?
Okay, fair enough. So that's a question we will have to address. Vayitchazek ha'am ish Yisrael v'yasifu l'aroch milchama b'makom asher achu sham b'yom harishon. So the second day they come back.
You answered your question.
Excuse me?
Where else they use the Yashchitu?
Yiftach against B'nai Ephraim. Actually, I just want to check something. Yeah, except there, interesting. There it's with the tet. There it's with the tet. Vayishchatuhu el marbot ha-yarden. There it's from the translation to the slaughter. Right? Shchita. Pshuta kemashmo. Here it means lashchit, which is to destroy, like by the mabo, lashachet kol basar. But the result, of course, is. Vayitchazek ha'am ish Yisrael v'yasifu l'aroch milchama b'makom asher achu sham b'yom harishon. Comes back the second day. Time to try this again.
Can I just interject something?
You may.
Now that you put the whole thing with Yiftach in there and this situation,
and Ephraim, right?
That it's, you know, he's motivated because he was rejected by his brothers.
Except that his war against B'nai Ephraim is not by his brothers.
But I'm saying he has all this pent-up anger. And then here you have a situation where they also have this anger against the brother.
Here it's righteous anger.
Right.
There's a difference. There's a difference. There it was an injustice to him. You know, he's a... What's the word I'm looking for?
Illegitimate?
No, he's a kind of barbarian, but he's a he's a bulvan. He's a, you know, how do you translate bulvan?
More, has more connotations than bulvan. Somebody who's just.
How do you translate a bulvan?
He's a wild man.
Yeah.
Awful without any structure behind it.
Yeah, wild, he's just wild. He's Yiftach. He grew up in Eish Tzov. He's an exile. They bring him back. They didn't want him in the first place, but they had no choice. He's a pagan. He sacrifices his daughter. I mean, he's complicated on multiple levels.
But they picked him because of that.
They picked him because they had no choice. Nobody else was going to stand up to the enemy. They were left with nobody. So they said, from Milet Brera, they went to him and they said, we have nobody else. And Yiftach said, thank you very much for the compliment. All right. Ve'alu b'nei Yisrael. So now before they go to war the second day, they have to make atonement for the fact that they lost the first campaign. So ve'alu b'nei Yisrael ve'yivku lifnei Hashem ad ha'erev. So they come before God and they cried. And they ask God's counsel again. Should we again go to war against Binyamin, our brother? Notice the interjection of the word achi, which wasn't there the first time.
Right?
Maybe this, they begin to question their own legitimacy in this campaign, right? Should I do this again? Vayomer Hashem, alu alav. Yeah, do it again. Go. So, vayikru b'nei Yisrael b'nei Binyamin b'yom hashani. Second day, second campaign, do it again. Second day, second campaign, vayetzu b'nei Binyamin likvatam min hagibah b'yom hashani, vayashchitu b'nei Yisrael od shmonat asar elef ish arza kol ele shofei charev. Another 18,000 Israelites will pay the price for the second day of a campaign.
So, lost 10%.
So by now it's 40,000 out of 400. 10%.
Is that Shem choosing sides here?
That's the big question. God's role in this is the biggest question in the story. And that's something which we're going to, it's going to take us a few weeks to resolve. So I acknowledge the question. I do.
Stay tuned.
I don't have an answer. I've heard answers. I will share them with you, but I will. But I will put it on hold for now because we're just going to hold the question for now. Now they come back to Beit El. Now they're really stymied. They cannot understand the answer to Adina's question, to Ruthie's question. They are bothered by it. They come to the Urim V'Tumim once. They come to the Urim V'Tumim twice. They've cried. They've asked the question: should they go back? Shouldn't they go back? They don't know what to do with themselves. Vayevku, vayeshvu sham lifnei Hashem, vayatzumu bayamahu ad ha'arev. They cried, they fast, they tried to do tshuva. Vayelu olot u'shlamim lifnei Hashem. They bring sacrifices. They don't know which way to turn. Vayishalu b'nei Yisrael b'Hashem. Again, they seek God's counsel. Visham Aron Brita Elokim ba'imimahem. The Aron Brita Elokim is there in those days. The interjection of that verse is very interesting. It's unclear as to why the Navi needs to tell me that the Aron Brita Elokim is there. Of course it's there. It's the Mishkan. So there's several theories. The Radak offers one suggestion that maybe they're not in Shiloh. Maybe they're in Beit El, as in Beit El of Sefer Breshit, and that they brought the Aron from Shiloh to Beit El, which is why it tells me that the Aron is there. Alternatively, it's telling me that when they sought counsel of God, it wasn't like during periods of time when the Mishkan was in destruction or in ruins, and they didn't have the Urim V'Tumim, or they didn't have the Aron functioning. They had a fully functional mikdash with the Aron, with the Mizbeach, with the Kohen Gadol, with the Urim V'Tumim. Remember, if this is written by Shmuel, and Shmuel lives through the Churban of Shiloh. So it's not an insignificant fact to tell us where this is happening when the Aron is there. Not only that, it tells us who the Kohen is. The Kohen is an old friend of ours. ופנחס בן אלעזר בן אהרון העומד לפניו בימים מהם. The coin is Pinchas. Remember Pinchas?
The guy who killed the Midianite woman.
Right. Pinchas from Sefer Shmot, of Bamidbar fame. Right. Pinchas of Chumash fame, not Pinchas of Eli's Pinchas. That's 400 years later.
He has a Brit Shalom.
Brit Shalom. Right. And they ask again for the third time, Ha'osif od latzet lemilchama b'nei Binyamin achi imechdal. Should I again go out to war against Binyamin, my brother, or not? I mean, maybe this is wrong. Vayomer Hashem, third time lucky. Alu, ki machar etnenu biyadecha. Go, tomorrow I'll make you victorious.
How do we understand Pinchas being mentioned? Is this the chronology that...
That's one of the proofs that this is an early story. One of the strongest indicators that this is an early story is the reference to Pinchas. If I put the story late, if I put the story at the end of Sefer Shoftim, then I really have to assume that Pinchas is 300 years old at this point, and that feeds into the literal reading of the Medrash that Pinchas and Eliyahu HaNavi is the same person. If I take that Medrash more figuratively and less literally, then I have to assume that this is an early story.
Why did Binyamin lose?
We're about to read. I'm going to even out the score. Vayasem Yisrael Orvim El Agiva Saviv. Third day, third campaign, Hashem says go. Now they're a little bit more cautious. Frontal attack twice didn't work. Now a little more caution is required. So they lay in ambush and they plot this out. Now what remains in the rest of this parak, from Pasuk Lamed till the end of the parak, is the battle plan. And it's a complicated battle plan. What makes it more complicated is it's a simple battle plan conceptually, it's a complicated battle plan textually. Because in the text, it actually goes through the story several iterations from different vantage points. So it keeps going back on itself. A full description of all of the details of it will go through the next time we meet. But I want to go through the sort of bird's eye view of it, and I'll share, and I'll give you this map. This map will help understand a little bit of what takes place. So there are pieces of the story that repeat themselves, but in the end, there's a conclusion that'll bring it all together. Okay. Everybody with me? So on this map, you see where it says Benjamin on the bottom? Yehuda Benjamin? Jebus? Yevus. Right? Yevus, Yerushalayim. Givah, just above it. Now, what's going to confuse us in the story is that there's two cities in Benjamin that have very similar names. One is Givah, and the other is Geva. They're almost interchangeable, because sometimes one is referred to by the name of the other. But anyway,
there's also one.
And there's Givon, which is famous from the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua,
right.
Ramah, Mitzpeh, which is where they started gathering. North of that is Beit El. So on this map it says intertribal gathering in Mitzpeh. Then stage two, you see the verse is a little bit out of sequence. Israelites retreat, and then we'll read the psukim. Let's go.
Why do we need to know all of these?
Because that's what's in the
Chumash. Jewish history, part of Tanakh.
But all the battles, or this is the most important that we get all these?
No, all the battles. A lot of the battles. We had this by eye, almost verbatim. The style here, by the way, the style of victory is very reminiscent of the style by eye. When they lost the first time around, they used that loss to their advantage. But because of a false sense of victory, victory, and lured the inhabitants out of the fighters out of the city, and then there was an ambush that raised the city to the ground from behind. It's exactly the same battle plan that's used here. It's exactly the same battle plan. Vayalu b'nei Yisrael al b'nei Binyamin b'yom ha'shlishi v'yarchu el ha'giva kifam b'fam. Third day, similar attack from as they had done in the past. Vayetzu b'nei Binyamin likrat ha'am hon tzuku min ha'ir. People, I mean, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. B'nai Binyamin
counterattack the people of Israel, as they have in the past. They left the city. They left the city because they were ready to go pursue the pursuers. And they began to smite the Israelites as they had in the past. Bamisilot asher achat ola Beit El veachat Givata. In two roads leading out of Giv'ah, one leading to Geva, and the other leading to Mitzpeh, to Beit El. Kishloshim Yisrael, they killed 30 Israelites, so they're ready to pursue. Vayomru b'nei Binyamin nigafim hem lefneinu kivari shana. B'nei Binyamin said one to another, Israel, they're in retreat again, like before. V'nei Yisrael amru nanuso netku min ha'ir la'misilot. B'nei Yisrael are thinking, okay, we're going to turn and we're going to flee so that we can draw them out of the city onto the roads leading north of the city. V'chol ish Yisrael kamu mimkomo ve'archu beval Tamar. The rest of Israel are sitting and waiting in a place called Baal Tamar, unclear where it is. V'arev Yisrael megiach mimkomo mima'arei Geva. And the ambush are ready to pounce from the area of Geva. So what's going on essentially is that there are... one more pasuk. V'yavo mineged la'giv'a aseret alafim ish bachur mikol Yisrael v'milchama kaveda v'hem lo yadu ki nogat alehem hara'ah. There's essentially three groups in this battle. There's the original attacking force that comes against a frontal attack on the city, very quickly turns and retreats, moving into two directions. Northeast to Giv'ah, to Geva, north to Beit El, forcing the pursuing army of Israel, of Binyamin, to
divide
and to run north, abandoning the city because they think that, like before, the forces of Israel are in Mitzpeh. They're gathering from Mitzpeh, they're coming down from the north to the city of Giv'ah. They're now in retreat, they're pursuing. In the meantime, there are two waiting groups of Israelites. There is the gathering of all of the forces of Israel in Baal Tamar, so essentially to finish the job against Binyamin. And there is an ambush waiting to enter the city of Giv'ah from behind. And those two groups have two different purposes in the story. One is going to, as the forces of Binyamin retreat, it's going to burn the city, raise the city, and thereby the smoke that will go up from the city that has been destroyed will, on the one hand, dishearten the fighters of Binyamin, because the city behind has been abandoned and destroyed, on the other hand, be a signal to the rest of Israel that it's time to turn around and attack. The fleeing forces will see the smoke, turn around, and counter-offensive against the fleeing forces, the pursuing forces of Binyamin, and the rest of Israel is sitting in Baal Tamar and waiting. They will play cleanup. They will go and then wipe out the rest of Binyamin and all the different cities of Shevet Binyamin. Everybody with me?
Where's Baal Tamar?
Baal Tamar is not there. And I looked up in Das Mikra, they're not sure where Baal Tamar is, but it's essentially the, let's call it the countryside. Vayigof Hashem et Binyamin lifnei Yisrael. Now look at the phraseology, right? So now Binyamin is going to fall before Israel. Who is causing Binyamin to fall before Israel?
Hashem.
So Hashem now has played, you'll forgive me for saying so,
chosen sides.
Both sides. It only strengthens the theological question that we raised before. Vayashchitu b'nei Yisrael b'Binyamin b'yom ahu. 25,000 Binyaminites will fall on this day. Kol Eile Sholef Charef. Sholef Charef means combatants. In modern terminology, we would say those are the combatants.
That's most of them.
Well, we're going to see this another component to this battle as well. Vayihu b'nei Binyamin ki nigafu. Vayitnu b'nei Binyamin saw that they were being smitten from behind. Israel had given them false hope by retreating because they were relying on the ambush from behind. The ambush, now shifting gears, focus on this ambush for a moment, the ambush from behind the city. They approached the city from behind. And they smote the city. Who's left in the city? If the soldiers have all left, what's left in the city? Women and children left in the city are the inhabitants of Giva, or the old men who couldn't fight, whatever the non-combatants we call it. There was a signal that Ish Yisrael had with this ambush. When the smoke would go off from the city, that was a signal to the pursuing forces, the fleeing forces of Israel, to turn around. So that's what they did. So they turned around to fight against Binyamin. And Binyamin began to fall before Israel, ki amru ach nigof nigaf hu lefanenu kemuchama rishana. Israel, Binyamin was pursuing because, Binyamin, we're going back to the beginning of the story. Binyamin echel lakot chalalim b'ishisok yishloshim. Binyamin had smitten the first 30 Israelites, thinking that they were pursuing, that they were victorious like they had the day before. That this is a repeat to the verse we had earlier. Ve'amaset echel la'alot min ha'ir amud hasham. It means on the smoke went up from the city, and they saw that the city behind them was destroyed. They turned behind them and they saw the city burnt. And Israel turned around. The fleeing Israelites now turned around. Confused and confounded Binyamin. And then Binyamin saw they were in trouble. So they retreated. Fled. Thank you. Into the midbar. Vashemiharim. Clean up in the cities around, not just of Giva. Mashchitim oto betocho. So now the Israelite forces literally just swarming down, 400,000 of them, swarming down over the cities of Binyamin, destroyed. Kitru et Binyamin, hirdifuhu, minuchai drichu, a bit of a shira about wipe out Binyamin, flee after them, run after them, ad nocha chagiva mi mizoch shamash. Vayiplu mi Binyamin, shmana asa elef ish. 18,000 Binyaminites. Kol eila anshe chayil. So in addition, either part of the original 25,000 or separate, another 18, unclear.
Where they come from?
Right, we'll see. So it's either part of, because we're repeating the story, or it's an addition to. Vayifnu vayanusu amidbar el sela harimon. So they flee into an area called Sela Harimon, the rock or the cleft of Rimon. Vayolulu bamsilot, and Israel pounced on them on the roads. Chameshet alafim ish, 5,000 people. So there's your answer. 18,000 in the war, 5,000 in the pounce on the retreat. Together is your 22,000. Another 2,000 along the way. By the time this is all done, Ish 25,000 swordsmen. That's how it breaks up. 18,000 in the initial campaign, another 5,000 in the another 2,000. So it all breaks up.
So Kol
Eila Anshe Chayil. Vayifnu, we're not finished. Vayifnu, Vayanusu Hamidbar El Sela Rimon 600 Ish, 600 men flee and hide in the cleft of Sela Rimon. Vayeshu B'Sela Rimon Arba Chodashim, and there they remain for 4 months. Hiding in Sela Rimon from the Israelite forces. In the meantime, for Ish Yisrael, after they finished wiping out the 25,000 combatants, Vayish Yisrael Shavu El Bnei Binyamin Vayakum Lefichev, come back to the cities of Binyamin, Meir Metom Ad Behema Ad Kol Animtza, everybody left, including the animals, Gam Kol HeArim Animtzaot Shilchu Baesh, and raised the entire, all the cities to the ground. Reminiscent of, there's one mitzvah in the Torah that talks about destroying not only the inhabitants of the city, but also the animals of the city, and burning the city to the ground. There's one mitzvah that mandates such a response to a city. It's called? Nope. Specifically, one mitzvah in the Torah with regards to Avodah Zarah that mandates the destruction of a city in exactly this fashion. Everybody in the city, including the inhabitants, including the animals, including the money, everything gets burnt. Not a Amalek. Specific reference to a city that must be completely obliterated in exactly this fashion. Burnt to the ground. Everything is burnt, everything is destroyed, everything is wiped out. Mitzvah in the Torah, mandated mitzvah in the Torah.
When we were studying Yahshua, wasn't there one city that they were supposed to destroy everything and they didn't destroy
Ai, correct. Oh, Yericho. And they paid the price for it by Ai. But there is a mitzvah
what
in the Torah.
The city with Abraham
a mitzvah, a mitzvah, a mitzvah. We're not talking about a story, I'm talking about a mitzvah.
He gave up.
Mitzvah of Ir Hanidacha. What's an Ir Nidachat? Mitzvah Ir Nidachat? That's what we're going to start with next week. Mitzvah Ir Nidachat is a city that is completely overrun by idolatry. And the mitzvah in the Torah is to not only obliterate the city, but to raise the city to the ground.
Specific city.
That mitzvah essentially is the analogy here to the behavior of Binyamin. 25,000 combatants go back to the city of Giva, and the inhabitants of the city of Giva add them to the mix, and you probably have an equation somewhat analogous to the 40,000 that were killed on the Israel side as well. And by the time the story is over, both sides have suffered loss of significant proportions. God's behavior in this discussion needs to be resolved. B'ezrat Hashem, next week we will continue.